Hello and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday, the 22nd of May. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. This week we look at the effect of the British taxpayers' money being used to help the war on drugs in Colombia. Is that money helping or hindering the drugs lords? Colombian journalist Claudia Julieta Duque explains how British money is being part of the problem and not the solution. We also have in the studio local journalist Danny Penman is here, and he's going to be telling us about his new book, Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Finding Peace in a Frantic World.
Anthea Page visits Global Plants in Frampton-on-Severn. We also have the latest episode of our serial. We hear about the real pubs believed to have been written in Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. We've also got poetry courtesy of Rosemary Dunn and Trevor Carter. Dialect is produced by volunteers and we're broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2. Hello also to our listeners in Preston FM and also in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join in, we are a volunteering thing, so contact Volunteering Bristol if you live in our area. We're just off Queen Square and the details of that will be at the end of the show. I'd like to introduce author and journalist Danny Penman to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
So tell us a bit about yourself. What's your background?
Well, I'm a journalist. I work predominantly for several newspapers, The Independent and The Daily Mail, as a feature writer.
Okay. So how did you start out as a journalist?
My first job, I was very lucky in that I worked for The Independent.
Pretty good start. Right at the top of the ladder. That's a good start, isn't it?
And it's, some say it's been downhill ever since.
Okay, fair enough. So I mean, I've invited you into the studio to chat about a new book that you've written, Mindfulness. It's called, subtitled, A Practical Guide to Finding Peace in a Frantic World. Tell us about this franticness. When did you first observe that you were going to need to find some peace?
Well, I learned to meditate when I was about 16 or 17. Rather oddly, I was taught it at my local comprehensive school. And it was quite revolutionary in those days, you know, 20-odd years ago. I'd only used it off and on to deal with the usual stresses and strains of daily life. But then 5 years ago, I had a rather nasty paragliding accident in the Cotswolds.
Right.
And I fell about 30 feet after the wing collapsed and drove the lower half of my right leg through the knee into my thigh. And as I didn't have any painkillers with me at the time,
I'm squirming in my seat. The carry-on.
Yeah, it was pretty grim, I can assure you.
Right.
So with no painkillers, I tried the only thing that was available, which was this form of meditation I'd learned as a teenager.
Okay, so this is like being dropped in at the deep end. Extreme
Absolutely.
Meditation to overcome absolute pain. Did it work?
It did. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I could still feel it to a degree, but it was as if there was like a thin mist between me and the pain. So it allowed me to cope with the pain. But it was pretty grim. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it as your first lesson in meditation.
Any trip to your local bookshop like Waterstones will see shelves heaving, oversaturated with lots of self-help books. So what sort of made you think, well, hang on, a book about this is going to be really useful?
Well, I teamed up with the developer of what's known as mindfulness-based cognitive therapy.
Right.
And this is essentially a form of mindfulness meditation that's been around for, 2,500 years, mixed with cognitive behavioural therapy. And it was developed at Oxford University by a wonderful man, Professor Mark Williams.
Okay.
And this therapy is being rolled out across the NHS, because it's one of the most effective treatments for kind of anxiety, stress, and depression.
Right.
And it's so effective that it's recommended by the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. And I realized that people needed to know about this. So I teamed up with Mark and, you know, we decided to turn this into a book that, you know, is relevant to everyday, ordinary people.
Okay, so it starts out sounding like a little bit like it's sort of an alternative therapy, but actually it's not at all.
It started off as an alternative therapy, but now it's becoming very mainstream. If you look at the statistics, it's at least as effective as the best antidepressants.
And cheaper, possibly.
Oh, dramatically cheaper, yeah. I mean, the maintenance dose of antidepressants can be many hundreds of pounds per year, whereas this is, well, you could buy the book or you could go on a course that could well be paid for by the NHS or would cost you only 130 quid, you know,
okay,
compared that to.
So, I mean, aside from, you know, people sort of like Prince Charles loving anything that started off as an alternative therapy, I mean, what evidence do we have that it's working as such?
Well,
despite the fact that it's cheaper.
There's been 6 major international clinical trials using mindfulness-based cognitive therapy now, and they all show a consistent picture of roughly halving the risk of depression or suffering a relapse of depression.
Okay. I mean, what about people who say, well, you know, antidepressants are working perfectly well, so why shouldn't I just carry on taking these things?
Well, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say. And, you know, you should never advise somebody to come off things like antidepressants quickly. But this is an extra string to your bow. There are lots of reasons why you might not wish to take antidepressants. For example, if you're pregnant or breastfeeding, or, you know, they might have quite powerful side effects. So it's just useful to have an alternative.
Did you read a lot of the other books revolving around sort of similar topics about sort of depression and why so many people are, in fact, depressed? For example, like Affluenza by Oliver James is quite a popular one. I mean, depression seems to be a big topic.
It is. And whilst lots of people talk about depression, very few people offer actual alternative, you know, real treatments that aren't chemical based. I mean, essentially, they're saying, you know, just cheer up, or, you know, don't be so materialistic, or this, that, and the other. But it's very difficult to actually change your mind about anything. What you have to do is, in essence, step outside of your own thought patterns. And that's what mindfulness meditation does. The problem with trying to change your mind, really, is your thoughts are almost invariably governed by your emotional state at the time.
Yeah.
For example, if you're unhappy, your mind will conjure up all kinds of negative, depressing thoughts. And it's extremely difficult to stop that process. You can't stop that process. So what you need to do is actually just calm down and soothe your frayed nerves and realize that whilst you're feeling unhappy and depressed, that might not be an accurate reflection of the world. And, you know, you just need to step outside of those negative thought patterns.
Right. So what do you do when you're engaging in mindfulness meditation? I mean, one assumes you don't necessarily have to be in the lotus position at the time, but what you're actually doing?
No, I mean, you don't. It's kind of always slightly annoying when you see articles about meditation in magazines, and they always have the same picture.
Do you have to be anywhere particularly?
Nope, you can meditate on the train, walking down the street. Often it's best in a quiet place at home. The meditations in the book are extremely simple and straightforward. The simplest one of all is just concentrating on your breath for 10 minutes, sensing the feelings as the air flows in and out of your lungs or through your nostrils. And it's a tremendously therapeutic process. It's very simple and extremely cheap.
Okay. I noticed that I had a flick through the introduction, because I didn't have time to read all the book before it came in, but I noticed it said one of the things is that, you know, a lot of people engage in overthinking, over-worrying, and similar sort of phrases such as this. Were you ever like this? What is it like to, you know, how can somebody spot, you know, am I worrying too much? Am I thinking about things too much? How can people tell if they're getting too worked up, as opposed to just what people might see as worrying the appropriate amount as to what they're having to deal with?
One of the most disturbing things is virtually everybody is now guilty, as it were, of overthinking. We all do it virtually all of the time. For example, the normal levels of stress and anxiety that most people feel today would be classed as clinical level anxiety and stress 50 years ago. And
even if somebody's thinking, well, this doesn't really apply to me, it might actually, if they stop them.
Well, you know, virtually everybody can benefit from mindfulness meditation. 600 studies now around the world have shown that meditation improves health.
What do you think about the level of the population? Do you think that kind of contributes to stress? Because a lot of people are saying, you know, overcrowding and overpopulation is leading people to be a bit like too many rats in a cage.
Well, I'm not sure, really. I mean, to me, one of the most stressful things would be, you know, starving to death.
Or well, right, fair enough.
Yeah. And yet, there is no relationship between poverty and, you know, overpopulation and levels of stress and, you know, things like that.
So why are more people sort of becoming depressed? Do you think that's just more people are aware of depression and think, oh, I might have that? Or do you actually becoming depressed?
No, I think they are becoming genuinely depressed.
And so what's causing that, do you think, really?
Well, there's many, many different factors. We live in a society that is becoming increasingly atomised. We live in a society that's becoming increasingly selfish. And all of those factors contribute to unhappiness and stress and anxiety and depression.
Okay, where can people find out more besides looking up in their local bookshop?
A good starting point is our website, franticworld.com. com, and that gives an outline of the book, and it also gives people an opportunity to get further help as well.
Okay. Well, the book is called Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Finding Peace in a Frantic World. The handy quotes are recommending the book from Ruby Wax on the front cover, if you should possibly need persuading, on top of what's already been said. And it's written by Mark Williams and Danny Penman. So, Danny, thank you very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you very much.
If you want to find out more about behavioural control therapy, I've also got a recommended link here to check out mbct.co.uk. Nick Mason is hailed as a local hero in Frampton-on-Severn near Bristol. Nick travels all over the world collecting rare plants, which he sells in his nursery. Dialect's reporter Anthea Page went to visit Nick in Frampton at his beautiful walled garden. But first, let's intro it with a little musical ditty from Rolf Harris.
Dragonflies and moths and bees, spiders falling from the trees, butterflies sway in the cool, gentle breeze. There are wasps, empty homes, and tiny little gnomes in an English country garden. How many songbirds? Actually, I've seen some of these gardens they talk about, and the sort of impression you get is that it's wet underfoot and the leaves are thick with soot in an English country garden. Newspapers torn and strewn across the lawn in an English country garden. Littered garbage in the yards, little doggies calling cards, one scraggy rosebud peering through the weeds, for they've all down tools while they fill their football pools in an English country garden. Market, join the common market.
I'm in Plan Global Plants in Frampton-on-Severn near Bristol, and I'm here with the owner of the business. Hello.
Hello, Nick Mason.
Tell us about this wonderful garden that you've created.
Do you mean the garden or the nursery as such?
Well, it's all. It's a garden and nursery, isn't it?
It is really, yeah. The garden that never gets enough attention, to be honest, but the nursery, I've been going 14 years. I used to have a nursery in Painswick, and I moved down here 8 years ago, down to Frampton. I was offered a lovely old walled garden, lovely old 18th century walled garden. I took up the offer because it's a top spot to have a nursery, basically. I converted half of it to a garden. As I said, don't have enough time to deal with the garden, but it's half decent, I think you'll agree. And the nursery I spend all my time on, which is selling rare plants, basically, for your garden.
Can you tell us a bit more about the plants? Because there's plants here that I've never seen in any other nursery.
That's, you know, it was my aim always to sell unusual things. I'm interested in unusual plants. That's my angle. I go collecting in the wild every year, various parts of the world, collecting seed from far off locations. But also I get together all sorts of rarities from Britain. There's an amazing amount of diversity in British gardens. There's some incredible people in Britain growing an incredible variety of things. Just a look in the RHS Plant Finder book, which is also online nowadays, will show you the immense variety that we have in Britain already and have had for a very long time. So there could be a very rare, interesting, beautiful, unusual, easily growable, whatever plant that you would think, wow, I've never seen that before anywhere, yet it's been in cultivation for 100 years.
Tell us about your latest trip. What did you bring back?
I was in northern Vietnam last November 2010. I brought back, I don't know, 150 seed lots, probably, of all manner of amazing things. Trees, shrubs, ferns, herbaceous plants. Only ever a small pinch of seed. I'm not into, you know, raping the wild. I think, to be honest, it's doing conservation a lot of favours, bringing a small amount of special rarities into Britain. Sometimes new species to science. I found the magnolia out there 2 years ago in northern Vietnam, which turned out to be unknown and was only described last year. Easily found if you know what you're looking for.
What's the most interesting plant you've ever discovered?
Couldn't possibly tell you that. You know, so many wonderful things. I spent 4 years travelling in Mexico, for example, you know, fabulous pine trees from the tops of mountains there, with blue needles, long blue needles, very, very exciting looking trees. Very growable in Britain. There's old trees of that particular type in one or two gardens. That's just an example. You know, there's one of my favourite things are agaves, which are spiky succulents. I found some pretty exciting ones of those in Mexico. Introduced some special ones. I got a new one this year from one particular area of Mexico with gorgeous blue-grey rosettes, squat, fat, wide leaves. Very, very exciting. And not necessarily growable in a winter like we've just had outside, but in a pot, easy, just dragged under cover or into a glass house, no problem at all. Pretty hardy plant, but not for the worst of the weather. It's amazing how, you know, I lose a lot of plants out here in Frampton, a very cold, rural, Gloucestershire sort of spot, but in the centre of Bristol it's much milder and people get away with all sorts. I've good customers from Bristol who come and tell me what they've got away with, and it's not a bad spot, Bristol.
How difficult is it to grow exotic plants once you bring the seeds back to Britain?
Depends what you mean by exotic. Exotic often means, you know, to most people, sort of tropical looking. But exotic is anything from outside the UK, really. So it depends what you mean by that. You know, most things are relatively straightforward, just to sow the seed, look after it, grow it on. Some things are very, very difficult. You know, bringing back spores of interesting ferns, for example, requires a whole different approach to germination.
Where's your next trip going to be?
I don't know. I haven't decided yet, actually. I've just been thinking about China yesterday. I haven't been to China. I've always left China to other people because everyone goes to China. Well, not everyone, of course. Most plant hunting types go to China. But there's always amazing things to be found. If you get off the beaten track, if you head off up mountains and down valleys in obscure places, you can always find amazing things. So maybe there, maybe back to Vietnam. I don't know. The world is my oyster.
Tell us about your website and how people can find you.
PanGlobalPlants.com, so it's PanGlobalPlants, all one word, .com, is easily found. And on the old website, you'll find directions to Frampton-on-Severn. But basically, if you want to just come to the nursery, it's as simple as driving to Junction 13 on the M5 up from Bristol, and then taking a left. And if you look on your map, Frampton-on-Severn lies just about 2 or 3 minutes' drive from Junction 13, and I'm just before the village on the left.
Just to go back to the very beginning, when you mentioned the garden, people, if they come to buy plants, can they wander around the garden as well?
Of course they can, no problem at all. Yeah, I mean, the garden looks a bit better later on in the season. I mean, I think you agree, it doesn't look too bad now.
It's beautiful.
But it's a lot of, I was experimenting with a lot of things here, a lot of semi-tender things, and we've just had the worst winter in 30 years, and a lot of them are dead, but it's been a lovely sunny spring, which has brought things on. I think we're probably about 2 weeks early, aren't we, in the season. It's brought things on nicely, so.
I think with being a walled garden, it's almost like a secret garden here. Yeah. You get that feeling that it's hidden away and a real gem.
Yeah, I like to think so.
Thank you to Anthea Page, and also thanks to Nick Mason in Frampton-on-Severn.
A South American country dominated by organised crime, drug running and its North American neighbour, Colombia is the most dangerous country in the world to be a journalist. And what's more, according to some Colombian journalists, British taxpayers' money is going to the very government agency supposed to be stopping money laundering, but which is colluding in assassinations of Colombian journalists. Claudia Julieta Duque was a guest of honour at the delegate meeting of the National Union of Journalists last month, and she was introduced by the General Secretary, Jeremy Deer.
Over 20 years as a journalist, she's documented multiple human rights abuses, exposing the involvement of state authorities, in particular the DAS security services themselves, in illegal activities against the media, against politicians, against NGOs and civil society organisations. One of her investigations into the 1999 murder of the renowned journalist Jaime Garzón unleashed a forces of hell against her, leading directly to the first conviction of the intellectual perpetrator of a journalist's murder. A former paramilitary commander was given 38 years in prison, and yet he disappeared and never served his sentence. Instead of those people going to jail, it is our guest speaker who is being sued for libel and slander. a familiar tactic used in Colombia to criminalise anybody who speaks out against the regime. Her case has been going on for more than 5 years now, during which time the authorities have destroyed countless documents and kept her under illegal surveillance and ignored court rulings. In order to provide support to her, the NUJ has sought to be joined in her legal case in Colombia, and I was honoured when I was in Bogotá to present her with honorary membership of our union. She hates talking about herself and her own case, and she knows that hers is just one case amongst so many in Colombia. 7 journalists killed there last year, and journalism under siege. But we're very proud to be supporting all of those journalists, and in particular her. Please give a very warm delegate meeting welcome to Claudia Julieta Duque.
Good morning, and thank you so much for this warmer welcome you gave me. The honor is all mine. To be part of the NUJ is something that I never expected, and for me it's a big honor, since this is the most important organization of journalists at national level in the world. So many thanks for your welcome and for being part of my fight now. As Jeremy said, I am not very good talking about my case, not only because I don't like to talk about me when Colombia lives a situation so hard to be the start in the middle of that is not my point, but also because my case is not the only one, as Jeremy said before. During the last 8 years, and particularly from 2008 to the president Álvaro Uribe Vélez, the former president of the country, he started a big campaign against the independent journalists in the country, and also against the trade unionists, the human rights defenders, and the opposition leaders, and even against the judges, the magistrates of the Supreme Court of Justice and the Constitutional Court, just because all of us, more than 300 people in the country, were doing something that he doesn't like, and is investigate and denounce or prosecuting, in the case of the justice, the human rights violations committed in the country. What happened in 2002 was that the organized crime took power in the country at national level. During the years before that, we have some kind of mafia regimes in the regions and in the rural zones, even in the political powers. But since 2002, what happened is that mafia regime came to power at national level in the person of Álvaro Uribe Vélez. And this means a significant change for all of us, and also a significant challenge, because we were governed by a mafia regime, which means, among other things, to be governed by criminals. Today, we have in jail more than 35% of the parliament, of the national parliament, the national congress, because their members were closely linked to paramilitary groups and drug traffickers. And because of that, they were elected, thanks to the massacres, the killings, and the persecution against civilian population. So this was what we were denouncing. This was that we were investigating when the harassment started. And Álvaro Uribe tried to put the journalists in a corner where the journalists were not dangerous anymore for the government. And he he made it, he achieved it. And that's a big problem for us, and it's also a huge legacy for the new government. This week, Colombia was news, not only here in the UK, but also at international level, because two reports on human rights were released. One of them was the report of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the British government, and the other one was the US State Department report. Both of these reports coincide in saying that the change of the style in the statement of the new president, Juan Manuel Santos, is a big and important and positive change for all the Colombians. And this is very strange for me, and it's very sad too, because it's the only good news. The only good news we have now in Colombia is the statement has changed publicly, but the practice is the same one. I can say you certainly that the espionage, the legal surveillance, the death threats continue, but not publicly. Now, this has another practice or another delegations, maybe, because there are paramilitary groups that are behind the threats, and because the secret police, that is the state institution in charge of espionage and persecution against the opposition, is doing this job with more quiet. But it doesn't mean that it has ended, no? So for journalists in Colombia, the situation is not much different now than during the government of Álvaro Uribe. Last year, we have 57 journalists that were under threat in 12 months. During these three last months, we have 23 journalists under threat. Among them, of course, is my name. And we have 18 radio stations in the regions that have been threatened with bombings and killings and disappearances if they continue reporting what is happening in the rural zones. So nothing has changed. The only change is the statement. And it's very sad when the international community accepts the hypocrisy as the only possibility for the human rights reality. And my work in Colombia is to denounce and to investigate and to continue highlighting the situation for the victims that during last 2 years we had lost more than 1,500 leaders of the movement of victims in Colombia that were fighting for their rights. We have several and very serious situations in the field with displaced people, forced displaced people, and we have worse realities every day, but we have less journalists talking about that. And it's because 8 years ago, the government started this big campaign against the truth and the opposition and the investigation of human rights abuses in the country.
That was Colombian journalist Claudia Julieta Duque explaining the conditions human rights activists, trade unionists and journalists have to operate under in Colombia, and how the British government is funding a Colombian government agency, the Group of Reactive Operations, which is in fact involved in political kidnappings and assassinations. The British government, of course, denies these claims. Next week, we hear how the Colombian government is trying to improve its mafia state image around the world while the killings go on. You can read more about this story on the National Union of Journalists Bristol website, which is www.bristolnuj.org.uk. Treasure Island is an adventure novel by Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson, narrating a tale of pirates and buried gold. First published as a book on the 23rd of May 1883, there are a number of inns which claim to have been the inspiration for places in the book, In Bristol, the Landogger Trow is claimed to be the inspiration for Admiral Benbow. The Hole in the Wall in Bristol is claimed to be the Spyglass Tavern. And in Penzance, Cornwall, there's a 17th century inn named Admiral Benbow. Malcolm Green reads this week's episode of Treasure Island.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 1, The Old Buccaneer. Chapter 4, The Sea Chest. I lost no time, of course, in telling my mother all that I knew, and perhaps should have told her long before, and we saw ourselves at once in a difficult and dangerous position. Some of the man's money, if he had any, was certainly due to us, but it was not likely that our captain's shipmates, above all the two specimens seen by me, Black Dog and the beggar, would be inclined to give up their booty in payment of the dead man's debts. The captain's order to mount at once and ride for Dr. Livesey would have left my mother alone and unprotected, which was not to be thought of. Indeed, it seemed impossible for either of us to remain much longer in the house. The fall of coals in the kitchen grate, the very ticking of the clock, filled us with alarms. The neighbourhood, to our ears, seemed haunted by approaching footsteps, and what between the dead body of the captain on the parlour floor and the thought of that detestable blind beggar hovering near at hand and ready to return, there were moments when, as the saying goes, I jumped in my skin for terror. Something must be resolved upon, and it occurred to us at last to go forth and seek help in the neighbouring hamlet. No sooner said than done, bareheaded as we were, we ran out at once into the gathering evening and the frosty fog. The hamlet lay not many hundred yards away, though out of view, on the other side of the next cove. And what greatly encouraged me, it was in an opposite direction from that whence the blind man had made his appearance, and whither he had presumably returned. We were not many minutes on the road, though we sometimes stopped to lay hold of each other and hearken, but there was no unusual sound. Nothing but the low wash of the ripple and the croaking of the crows in the wood. It was already candlelight when we reached the hamlet, and I shall never forget how much I was cheered to see the yellow shine in doors and windows. But that, as it proved, was the best of the help we were likely to get in that quarter, for you would have thought men would have been ashamed of themselves. No soul would consent to return with us to the Admiral Benbow. The more we told of our troubles, the more, man, woman, and child, they clung to the shelter of their houses. The name of Captain Flint, though it was strange to me, was well enough known to some there and carried a great weight of terror. Some of the men who had been to field work on the far side of the Admiral Benbow remembered, besides, to have seen several strangers on the road, and taking them to be smugglers, to have bolted away, and one at least had seen a little lugger in what we call Kit's Hole. For that matter, anyone who was a comrade of the captain's was enough to frighten them to death. And the short and the long of the matter was that while we could get several who were willing enough to ride to Dr. Livesey's, which lay in another direction, not one would help us to defend the inn. They say cowardice is infectious, but then argument is, on the other hand, a great emboldener. And so when each had said his say, my mother made them a speech. She would not, she declared, lose money that belonged to her fatherless boy. If none of you will rest your dare, she said, Jim and I dare. Back we will go the way we came, and small thanks to you big, hulking, chicken-hearted men. We'll have that chest open if we die for it. And I'll thank you for that bag, Mrs. Crossley, to bring back our lawful money in. Of course, I said I would go with my mother, and of course they all cried out at our foolhardiness. But even then, not a man would go along with us. All they would do was give me a loaded pistol lest we were attacked, and to promise to have horses ready saddled in case we were pursued on our return, while one lad was to ride forward to the doctor's in search of armed assistance. My heart was beating finely when we two set forth in the cold night upon this dangerous venture. A full moon was beginning to rise and peered redly through the upper edges of the fog, and this increased our haste, for it was plain before we came forth again that all would be as bright as day, and our departure exposed to the eyes of any watchers. We slipped along the hedges, noiseless and swift, nor did we see or hear anything to increase our terrors till, to our huge relief, the door of the Admiral Benbow had closed behind us. I slipped the bolt at once, and we stood and panted for a moment in the dark, alone in the house, with the dead captain's body. Then my mother got a candle in the bar, and holding each other's hands, we advanced into the parlour. He lay as we had left him, on his back, with one arm stretched out. "Draw down the blind, Jim," whispered my mother. "They might come and watch outside. And now," said she when I had done so, "we have to get the key off that. And who's to touch it, I should like to know." And she gave a kind of sob as she said the words. I went down on my knees at once. On the floor, close to his hand, there was a little round of paper, blackened on the one side. I could not doubt that this was the black spot. And taking it up, I found written on the other side, in a very good, clear hand, this short message: "You have till 10 tonight." "You had till 10, mother," said I. And just as I said it, our old clock began striking. The sudden noise startled us shockingly, but the news was good, for it was only 6. "Now, Jim," she said, "that key." I felt in his pockets, one after the other. A few small coins, a thimble, and some thread and big needles, a piece of pigtail tobacco bitten away at the end, his gully with the crooked handle, a pocket compass, and a tinderbox were all that they contained, and I began to despair. "Perhaps it's round his neck," suggested my mother. Overcoming a strong repugnance, I tore open his shirt at the neck, and there, sure enough, hanging on a bit of tarry string which I cut with his own gully, we found the key. At this triumph we were filled with hope and hurried upstairs, without delay, to the little room where he had slept so long, and where his box had stood since the day of his arrival. It was like any other seaman's chest on the outside, the initial B burned on the top of it with a hot iron, and the corners somewhat smashed and broken, as though by long, rough usage. "Give me the key," said my mother, and though the lock was very stiff, she had turned it and thrown back the lid in a twinkling. A strong smell of tobacco and tar rose from the interior, but nothing was to be seen on the top, except a suit of very good clothes, carefully brushed and folded. They had never been worn, my mother said. Under that the miscellany began: a quadrant, a tin canikin, several sticks of tobacco, 2 brace of very handsome pistols, a piece of bar silver, an old Spanish watch, and some other trinkets of little value, and mostly of foreign make. A pair of compasses mounted with brass, and 5 or 6 curious West Indian shells. It has often set me thinking since that he should have carried about these shells with him in his wandering, guilty, and hunted life. In the meantime, we had found nothing of any value but the silver and the trinkets, and neither of these were in our way. Underneath there was an old boat cloak, whitened with sea salt under many a harbour bar. My mother pulled it up with impatience, and there before us lay the last things in the chest, a bundle tied up in oilcloth, looking like papers, and a canvas bag that gave forth at a touch the jingle of gold. "I'll show these rogues that I'm an honest woman," said my mother. "I'll have my dues and not a farthing over. Hold Mrs. Crossley's bag." And she began to count over the amount of the captain's score from the sailor's bag into the one that I was holding. It was a long, difficult business, for the coins were of all countries and sizes, doubloons and louis d'or, and guineas and pieces of 8, and I know not what besides, all shaken together at random. The guineas, too, were about the scarcest, and it was with these only that my mother knew how to make her count. When we were about halfway through, I suddenly put my hand upon her arm, for I had heard, in the silent, frosty air, a sound that brought my heart into my mouth. The tap-tapping of the blind man's stick upon the frozen road. It drew nearer and nearer, while we sat, holding our breath. Then it struck sharply on the inn door, and then we could hear the handle being turned and the bolt rattling as the wretched being tried to enter. And then there was a long time of silence both within and without. At last the tapping recommenced, and to our indescribable joy and gratitude died slowly away again until it ceased to be heard. "Mother," said I, "take the hole and let's be going." For I was sure the bolted door must have seemed suspicious and would bring the whole hornet's nest about our ears. But how thankful I was that I had bolted it, none could tell who had not met that terrible blind man. But my mother, frightened as she was, would not consent to take a fraction more than was due to her, and was obstinately unwilling to be content with less. It was not yet 7, she said, by a long way. She knew her rights, and she would have them. And she was still arguing with me, when a little low whistle sounded a good way off upon the hill. That was enough, and more than enough for both of us. "I'll take what I have," she said, jumping to her feet. "And I'll take this to square the count," said I, picking up the oilskin packet. The next moment we were groping downstairs, leaving the candle by the empty chest, and the next we had opened the door and were in full retreat. We had not started a moment too soon. The fog was rapidly dispersing. Already the moon shone quite clear on the high ground on either side, and it was only in the exact bottom of the dell and round the tavern door that a thin veil still hung unbroken to conceal the first steps of our escape. Far less than halfway to the hamlet, very little beyond the bottom of the hill, we must come forth into the moonlight. Nor was this all, for the sound of several footsteps running came already to our ears, and as we looked back in their direction, a light, tossing to and fro and still rapidly advancing, showed that one of the newcomers carried a lantern. "My dear," said my mother suddenly, "take the money and run, or I'm going to faint." This was certainly the end for both of us, I thought. How I cursed the cowardice of the neighbours, how I blamed my poor mother for her honesty and her greed, for her past foolhardiness and present weakness. We were just at the little bridge by good fortune, and I helped her, tottering as she was, to the edge of the bank, where, sure enough, she gave a sigh and fell on my shoulder. I didn't know how I found the strength to do it at all, and I'm afraid it was roughly done, but I managed to drag her down the bank a little way under the arch. Farther I could not move her, for the bridge was too low to let me do more than crawl below it. So there we had to stay, my mother almost entirely exposed, and both of us within earshot of the inn.
Here endeth the fourth episode of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, read for us, of course, by Malcolm Greaves.
Oh, it's a pleasure to introduce some poetry in the form of Rosemary Dunn. Hello.
Hello there.
Are you from Bristol? We've not had you in our studio before.
I am from Bristol, yes.
Ah, local heritage. Okay.
Absolutely.
What is your sort of line of poetic inquiry? What are your sort of themes? What would you like to do?
Well, I guess, I mean, I'm interested in things which are a bit off the water. I guess it's more like observational stuff. Yeah. And I also used to host Big Mouth Cabaret, which was going in Bristol for about 7 years, and the Poetry Tent at Ashton Court Festival.
Oh, you like Trevor Carter. He loves a good cabaret. He's often advertising a cabaret. You have a very nice looking book in your hand, which is in your name, called Laurie Lye Gets It On.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Which is available from my website.
Which is?
www.rosemarydunn.com. dun.co.uk.
And Dun is just D-U-N.
Absolutely.
Okay, always time for a plug on this show. Good. So read us a poem.
Okay, well, this poem is one that combines two of my favourite things, which are cheesy rhymes and men who wear glasses.
Okay.
So this is called Spectacles. I want to make passes at men who wear glasses. I'm not an avid fan of X-ray vision Superman. You see, my natural bent's more towards a Clark Kent. For when that Krypton boy's disguised, he's an X-rated four eyes. That's the first cheesy rhyme. And an unexploded, fully loaded sex bomb. Oh, give me a man with his specs on. I tend to make passes at men who wear glasses. It's that little boy lost makes him ripe for an accost. It's not the swagger of John Wayne. I much prefer a Michael Caine. Far better than soft porn is a man whose rims are horn. My obsession truly boggles, but I got a thing for goggles. With his crocodile rocking spectacles on, I even fancy Elton John. Whether or not he's got his kecks on, just give me a man with his specs on. I love to make passes at men who wear glasses. To me, you guys are sex on legs, whether glasses, bins or specs. There are plenty women out there gagging for your double-glazed stare. With your granny glasses on, you're like a Lennon who is John. I'm Buddy Holly's Peggy Sue, asking why you are so blue. With your spectacular spectacles on, you're as irresistible as a Eurovision song. Don't want a bruiser with bulging pecs, but a Guardian reader with big specs. Yes, I'm Eric Morecambe's Ernie Wise. Come on, baby, let's lock our glassy eyes. Throw those contacts in the trash. Give me love with extra glass. I'd like to eat you up stir-fried when our spectacles chink collide. I'd like to make a pass on my very vast futon to a man with his double glazing specs, saving sexy sex, specsy sin, bins, horn, rim, optical illusion, party, schmoozing, shy guy, four-eyed poet, crumpet, playing trumpet, miraculous, spectacular specs on. Yeah, baby, keep those glasses on.
To a Lennon who is John. What a fantastic line. There was a lot of suppressed tittering in the studio while that was going on. I understand that more of this suppressed tittering will be going on at the Hay and Wye Festival.
It will, yes. Yeah? Hopefully. And yes, I'm learning to play the banjo. So I'm doing I'm doing a poem on Brian Cox. Accompanied with a banjo.
Right.
Not a banjo, a ukulele.
God. A ukulele? Oh, come on.
I don't know the difference. A ukulele, no, sorry.
Well, on that theme, I mean, there is a YouTube video, I understand, of a Brian Cox spoof, which I've been recommended. So on that theme, look that up, because I'm sure it's very funny. But what date are you doing that?
I'm doing it on Wednesday, the 1st of June. I'm going to be in the Globe Field from 2:30 to 3:30.
Okay, for those with a Hay on Wye bent who like that sort of thing and who like that poetry, then go and check that out. Thank you, Rosemary.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure, as always, to introduce Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. Hello.
Hello, John.
Well, is there good news on the poetry front? What do you have for us this week?
Doing an event at the Polish Club on Tuesday.
Yes.
It's part of the Veggie Festival.
Right.
It's promoting vegan food. Mm-hmm. So we've got some of Bristol's top chefs who are going to compete.
Right.
In an exciting gastronomic competition.
Whereabouts is the Polish Club?
The Polish Club in St. Paul's Road.
St. Paul's Road. Yes. Okay.
It starts at 7.
Okay.
So there is some food. I think it's about £6, but you could track it down on Google. Veggie Festival.
Will you be there radiating charisma?
Yeah, I'm hosting the whole event.
You're hosting the whole event, okay.
Yes.
And reading poetry?
Amongst other things.
Amongst other things, okay. And what poetry do you have for us this week?
This week, well, it's it's a news event, because I haven't been here for a few weeks, but this is about Osama bin Laden's end.
Demise.
So it's called Rest Not in Peace. The world's most wanted man is dead. They've put a bullet in his head, though others will act in his stead. No one thinks it is the end of Al-Qaeda's crazed campaign. We know the threat will still remain to terrorize through death and pain. They're determined to offend our values that they so revile and put America on trial. dispensing ruthless carnage while their victims' bodies burn. In what they see as tit for tat, you've done this, so we'll do that. For the thinking of a theocrat does not leave space to learn that in the end he cannot win. Those who can't bend cannot begin to get to grips with power in a way that can make sense. To those who organise the stage, decide and shape the modern age, and how and when we all engage, as their power is immense. In this respect he was naive, for though his acts made thousands grieve, he has not changed what we believe, and thus we did resist him. And although he generated fear, what he's achieved is to make clear the values that we all hold dear, faith in our liberal system. Those who are certain they are right lead us into the darkest night. So we respond to might with might and fight unto the death. There is no space for compromise. An absolutist faith implies that others always speak in lies. So why not save our breath?
And what is the title of your latest book again?
My latest book is Children of the Fire.
Children of the Fire. And where can people find it?
They can find it wherever I am.
Wherever you are. Right, yes. So I'll have to track you down. Well, seeing as you're the Bard of Windmill Hill, you're probably there. Yes. So if people hang around there
just
long enough, they might see
you. The top of Windmill Hill, yes.
Right, okay, the top of Windmill Hill. Trevor Cotter, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Time for a What's On Guide. So hello to Jeff Sparks.
Hello, John. This is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting on Wednesday, 25th of May, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, with support from Munto Voldo, will be performing at the Colston Hall in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets cost £24, £26 and £27.50. Also on 25th of May, Badass Cowboys will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and entry is free. Into Thursday, 26th of May, Hayseed Dixie will be performing at the Cheese and Grain at Market Yard in Frome. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £16 in advance and £18 on the door. On to Song of the Week, I present Brooks Williams. With over 17 recordings and 23 years on the road, this American-born, UK-based singer-guitarist is classed as one of the best on the roots and blues scene. This is from his latest album, Baby O, and it's the song Amazing Grace. That was Brooks Williams with Amazing Grace from the album Baby-O. For more information, you can check out www.brookswilliams.com. On Friday, 27th May, Swingaroo Prohibition Ball, with music provided by the High Society Jazz Band, will be at Preston Masonic Hall in Saul Street, Preston. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets cost £10 for general admission. And for members in NUS, it's £10 if you're not dining and £18 if you are dining. Finally, on Saturday, 28th of May, it's the Dot to Dot Festival. This festival includes Hertz, We Are Scientists, The Naked and Famous, plus many more acts performing at various venues around Bristol. For more information, you can check out www.dotdotfestival.co.uk. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Will you be swinging your booty to the High Society Jazz Band, Jeff?
No, I won't be going up to that.
All right, fair enough. Thank you, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week. Time has flown. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, and will broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 3 in the afternoon on a Sunday. We're also broadcast on Preston FM and also in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you're outside Bristol on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, and that will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk.
Thanks to our studio guests, Danny Penman, Rosemary Dunn, Trevor Carter and Jeff Sparks. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Studio production this week was by Mike Noyce and the producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute because we're a volunteering thing. If you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web, bristolvolunteers.org.uk.
That was Dialect. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. We wish you a very good week from all the team in the Queen Square studio in Bristol City Centre. Thanks for your time. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye.